coming up on this episode of the Golf Central podcast, we're going to look back on the week that was at the Farmers Insurance Open, a somber Sunday with the death of NBA superstar Kobe Bryant. But we're going to break down all the action and also look forward to this week and the Waste Management Phoenix Open. But first, welcome into the Golf Central podcast presented by TaylorMade and the all-new Sim Driver. The driver head was in need of a drastic change in order to provide more performance, so TaylorMade changed the shape altogether with their new Sim Driver, which allowed them to make it fast and forgiving where every golfer needs it, the downswing. The pros love the new shape, but the biggest reason TaylorMade changed the shape was to help make you into a better golfer. Check out TaylorMadeGolf.com for more information on the all-new Sim family. And with that, as I said, I'm Will Gray. We're going to be joined in a minute here by senior writer Rex Hoggard. But first, I'm with Ryan Lavner. And Lav, just your overall thoughts on certainly a surreal and somber Sunday out there at Torrey Pines.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just an unimaginable tragedy. An NBA legend, just 41 years old, leaving behind three daughters and a wife. It was just unbelievable to see it play out in real time, too, at a sporting event, wondering, you know, do these players know? Do the caddies know? And we're going to have Rex Hoggard on, and him just getting the eerie vibe out there was just had been unbelievable. I was really impressed by how articulate the PGA Tour players were in all of their scrums afterward with reporters. You know, they're digesting news that they just learned probably in the scoring area. To be able to put Kobe's life and legacy in perspective just a few minutes after learning of the tragedy was really impressive, and I'm curious to get Rex's thoughts as well.
Yeah, I certainly think that it speaks to the cross-sport impact that Kobe had, and there's probably only a handful of guys whose death would have had that significant of an impact on PGA Tour players. I think Rex dug up the nugget. There were 13 players in the PGA Tour media guide that listed Kobe as their favorite athlete. That's how much of an impact that he had on this generation growing up, seeing him playing in LA and all that. But without further ado, we do bring in Rex, who was out in San Diego at Torrey Pines all week, and he was on the ground Sunday as this news kind of developed and then enveloped the entire tournament. Rex, thanks for joining us, and just walk us through, for those of us that weren't on the grounds in San Diego, what was that like in those couple of hours as the news started to dissipate, started to be confirmed, and then you started to wonder who knows what as a big golf tournament plays out?
I think Lav got it right. I think surreal was kind of the vibe on the property, and you could hear people in the crowd talking about it. It was a little surprising to me that when we finally got a chance to talk to players, and you're absolutely right, most of them found out in the scoring area. Tiger Woods himself found out. Caddy Joe LaCava told him as he walked off the 18th green, and Joe knew before that, but yeah, I mean, Tiger's playing for history, really. He was playing for his 83rd PGA Tour victory. That would have been the all-time record, and I think Joe made the right call in keeping it to himself until after the fact, but Tiger's reaction was what you would expect. It was, he kind of did a double take and hit him with the, what are you talking about? Because those two were very close. I mean, I don't think you could really put it into context, that relationship. I think hearing Tiger talking about how they developed, if you look at their career, they essentially mirrored each other. They both started in 1996. That's when they turned pro. That's when Kobe was drafted. About 2000 is when they hit their competitive stride and really started to do special things. And they both sort of peaked in their respective sports, and they also had their issues on and off the golf course injury-wise. And it was just fascinating to hear Tiger talking about his relationship, because I truly believe Kobe is one of those few people that Tiger can probably relate to as far as what it takes to be that ultimate athlete.
Well, you have a great article on golfchannel.com kind of exploring that relationship. And I think you're right. It's not only that Tiger understood Kobe, but it's that Kobe understood Tiger. And you get up to that, you know, 1% of 1% of elite and transcendent athlete. And it is hard to find a peer that really understands what you're going through and walks in your shoes for a season or a decade or what have you. But, you know, it was fascinating to see Tiger, as you said, react in real time and kind of start to digest this. But you immediately, it seemed, you understood how much of an impact not only the news had on him, but Kobe specifically had on him as they were growing up together.
Oh, absolutely. And what I found fascinating talking with other players as they came off the golf course, and there were plenty of fans. I mean, Max Homa, for example, he's an LA kid. He's been a Laker fan his whole life. I mean, Kobe was one of those guys he idolized. He's one, you know, Max was one of those 13 players who listed Kobe as his ultimate athlete. But I think it went beyond that. I think talking with him, there was a connection that not just Tiger made with him, but I think there's a connection that a lot of players make with the way Kobe sort of transcended that competitive balance, the way he always wanted to be a little bit better. I mean, Rory probably said it best when he told the anecdote, and we all know it, about Kobe making his team wait on the bus while he stayed in the gym and shot jumpers after a loss. And he was showing them what it takes to win, and I think that sort of trickled down to the players who grew up idolizing him. And it was fascinating the way he bridged sports.
Yeah, the thing that I really liked about your piece, Rex, was that I think MJ has always been the easy comparison with Tiger in terms of generational talent, larger-than-life personality. But Kobe probably fits Tiger's competitive DNA better. Just their insane work ethic, the will to win. You know, I don't think anyone looks at Kobe, yes, the scoring and the five titles and the 18-time NBA All-Star, but no one's ever looking at Kobe in terms of efficiency numbers and, you know, getting real deep into the metrics. And I don't think people, when Tiger's career is over, they'll be looking at that either. They're not going to be looking at his strokes gain numbers. They're going to be looking at his majors, his PGA Tour wins, kind of his gritty performances, whether it's the 08 U.S. Open or what he did last year at the Masters, coming back from all he went through physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Do you think he's closer to MJ, or do you think he's closer to Kobe?
I think that's a good analogy right there. And there was a sort of gritty kindred spirits between the two of them, and you just brought up half that example. 2008 U.S. Open at Torrey Pines, of course, I mean, I really feel like Tiger feels like that's the benchmark of his career. And there's been a lot of benchmarks, but when he looks back, and we joke about it, but he won a U.S. Open on one leg. I mean, let's face it, he was injured that week. He really shouldn't even have been playing. And yesterday when we asked him, you know, about what made Kobe special, he went to Kobe's moment, you know, Kobe's 2008 U.S. Open, which is he blew out his Achilles and then hobbled to the free throw line back in 2013 and made the free throws. And Tiger just was in awe over that because that's what Tiger would do, right? I mean, that's what his DNA demands. And he saw the same thing in Kobe. And you have to wonder how close they really were. It didn't sound like they were texting each other every night before they went to bed. But I do think there was sort of this relationship between the two of them that sparked very, very young and persisted over the course of their careers that was special, that was beyond what you might get, that Tiger probably gets with other athletes.
Well, there was a golf tournament that played out in and around this news as it broke Sunday afternoon. Mark Leishman shooting a great 65 to win. But the focus certainly this week was on Tiger as he made his first competitive start of the new year. Came close to victory number 83, but it's going to have to wait at least a couple more weeks. He finishes tied for ninth after a final round 70. Rex, what are your overarching thoughts on this first start of Tiger? It certainly seems like he's trying to ease his way into things. The goal, as always, is that second week in April, but this has to be considered a pretty good start.
Yeah, I think he was optimistic. I mean, there was not one question asked about his game or his round yesterday, which shows you kind of the way the narrative was going towards Kobe. But what he said earlier in the week was very, very telling. We all know he went to the new driver, the new sim driver, and hearing him talk, hearing people around him, he was able to pick up some speed. And what you saw over the course of 4 days was kind of this three-quarter swing, and yet he was still hitting it plenty far enough. And I think he's happy with the new golf ball that he has. The one flaw that you saw, and I think we've seen this the last 2 years, and it's something he's going to probably focus on, is his wedge play is not probably what he wants it to be. And I used the example Saturday afternoon on the 18th hole. Not an easy wedge shot, but he had no business flying it over the green into the bunker, and he ends up scrambling for par. But it was kind of a momentum killer, and I think that was one area that Tiger talked about that he wanted to focus on. But we keep going back to this idea of what does a 44-year-old Tiger fall back on? And it's hitting the ball in the fairway. It's hitting what you would really call that little baby cut, sort of bunting it out there is the words I think he used, and letting his iron play really stand out. And that's what he did all week long.
I think what really stood out to me, Rex, is that, you know, we've covered this Torrey Pines event, the three of us combined, over the last 10 years. And it kind of seemed like Tiger had been easing into the new year. He wasn't as sharp coming out of the holidays as he was probably in his prime. We saw, you know, he didn't have a top 20 finish besides 2013, his last week. He had one top 20 finish, and that was it. And this time, he was just so much sharper. It seemed like he really picked up where he left off at Royal Melbourne. And I was trying to find a a stat that kind of justified exactly what my eyes were telling me, and that, boy, he really doesn't have the big miss anymore. You know, if he did miss, he was just in a fairway bunker. He was just barely in the rough. There is a stat called distance from the edge of the fairway. Tiger led that stat by almost 5 feet.
That's pretty good.
He was leading the Farmers Insurance Open in distance from the edge of the fairway. That essentially means that he's not hitting those, 50-yard slices, those wild one-handed finishes anymore. He's right there and on a course that's going to be more forgiving. Obviously, the rough at Torrey Pines is some of the most penal that you're going to find on the PGA Tour. Torrey Pines is the hardest fairway to hit on the PGA Tour statistically. For him to be able to do that, that was the most encouraging thing to me. If he's hitting it 300, 305 with a little baby cut and keeping it in play, Rex, I mean, win number 83 can't be very far away.
I wouldn't think so. And I think everyone thinks at this point it's a foregone conclusion. As long as he stays healthy, what he was able to do at the Zozo last year to get number 82 is just kind of proof of that, where if he shows up and he's on his game, I think to your point, he was particularly sharp with his short game around the greens. And the driving is fascinating to me. I was walking with him during the Pro-Am on Wednesday, and we were on the 10th hole, and he had hit his second shot into the par five, and he turned around and he watched Rory McIlroy was on the tee. He wanted to see what Rory was going to do, and he wanted to see if Rory was going to take the bunker on the left, which is about a 310-yard carry. Of course Rory does, because he's Rory, right? That's what he does. And Tiger just sort of shakes his head, and I don't have that anymore. It wasn't aggravation. It wasn't he was smiling. He was just making a statement that, yeah, I can't do that. Like, he kind of turned to people, to Joe LaCava and some other people around him, and I'm going to have to play this hole a different way. He's got that 305 shot when he wants it, but I think he's becoming much more comfortable with something a little dialed back from that, where he knows he can just get it in the fairway. And no one is better with their long irons in the game than Tiger Woods.
He's dialing it back just like the rest of us. One swing at a time here. One more, Rex, before we let you go.
Still wants to hit bombs.
Yeah. You've got the 305 shot in there. One more before we let you go. You mentioned Rory. I wondered whose Sunday was more surprising between he and Jon Rahm. Rahm certainly was in, they're both in the final group. Rahm's in the lead, ends up rallying for second place, but they both got off to horrific starts on the front nine, which is the place where you're supposed to capitalize on Torrey South. And then they both started to come back a little bit, but which one left you scratching your head a little bit more on Sunday?
Probably Rory, just because he had been so sharp. I know he kind of had his ups and downs throughout the course of the week. And look, he hung in there. I mean, he got off to just a terrible start with three bogeys, I think, through his first four holes and turned it around. But the expectations were a little bit higher because this seems like a perfect golf course for him when he's sort of in that full flight mode. And he's probably at that point right now where I don't know how ready he really was when he showed up. I mean, he spent the last couple of days a lot like Tiger testing some new equipment. He was showing off the blisters on the fingers and everything, so you knew he'd put the work in, but I just don't know if he was quite where he needed to be. But you sort of saw the same thing from Rory last year on the West Coast, where he had an opportunity in LA and didn't get it done, and had an opportunity in Mexico and didn't get it done, and then he ends up and going on and being player of the year. So there's no alarm bells, but yeah, I was surprised. And a player of that caliber, when you get that close to the lead, you would expect him to at least make a play for it. And he really wasn't a factor late on the back nine.
Well, Rex Hoggard, I appreciate the insight as a man on the ground who was there for one of the more surreal, as you said, Sundays that we've had on the PGA Tour in quite some time. Rest up. I'm sure you'll be back at it before too long. But I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thanks, boys.
Well, Lav, Rex seems to think it was Rory. I kind of feel like it might have been Rahm.
It was absolutely Jon Rahm.
If we're trying to see which one left us scratching our head more, certainly, I mean, he was even money to win the tournament, coming in with a one-shot lead. He was a clear favorite, but just the start and
four over through the first five holes?
Yeah, just the butchering the third hole, which is not the place where you think you would be dropping shots. But what was your overall take from Rahm on
Sunday? that was by far the biggest surprise to me, is the way that Jon Rahm played with the 54-hole lead. You know, he's the number three ranked player in the world. He's won 10 times around the globe, but there seems to be something missing. And I think most players are more comfortable when they're in pursuit. And Jon Rahm showed that in the final round, that he was more comfortable when he'd seemingly blown the tournament and he could just try and rip off as many birdies as possible. Something doesn't quite match with Jon Rahm when he gets into the final round. You look at his PGA Tour record, he's only won three times Only, I say.
Yeah,
only. He's only one, but for a player of his caliber who's won 10 times around the globe, three times is not that many, including one of the times was with Ryan Palmer in a team
Devil's advocate would say he hasn't won on the PGA Classic. Tour because he's been busy winning on the European Tour. It's not like he's gone through droughts. He's
yes, but
he's
also putting in a full schedule on the PGA Tour.
Okay.
And so for the third-ranked player in the world, you would expect a little bit more, and he just hasn't done it in the final round when he's been in that 54-hole position. I put in the Monday Scramble. This was his second 54-hole lead, first coming last year at the Players' Championship when he blew up in the final round, ended up finishing T12. Other than that, he was T2 a couple times, ended up finishing outside the top three. There just seems to be something lacking when he gets in that position. He's so close from going on an absolute tear. His worldwide results since the U.S. Open are absolutely remarkable. But there's something to be said, the fact that he's never won a tournament without shooting 68 or better in the final round. He's not really the type of guy who's going to grind out a win. He's going to absolutely light it on fire and blow you away, and he wasn't able to do that yesterday at Torrey Pines.
To be fair, he has blown away some elite fields in the past, and he certainly has that extra gear that only a few guys do. But you know, one of the things that you and I as writers, when we're not on site, we'll kind of go through the night of or the morning after, we'll go through some of the quotes and see what some of the reporters asked of the players. And one that just caught me absolutely scratching my head with John Rahm is he said he thought he was one shot back playing the 18th hole. He's in the last group playing the 72nd hole. He said, "I did not look at the leaderboard again after I made the putt on 17. So he went to 18 thinking he's one shot back. And he said, "Well, the crowd didn't really react much to Mark Leishman finishing. So I thought he made par. In fact, Leishman made birdie. So Rahm needed eagle to make the playoff. He has a 2-putt birdie. He goes to caddy Adam Hayes. And Adam says, "Hey, nice try." And John says, "What do you mean? We're getting ready for a playoff." He had no idea that he was actually two shots back. Now, he said he would not have done anything differently on how he played the 18th hole. He did hit the green in two, left himself a long eagle putt, but very similar to the one
that he made 3 years ago.
Right, that he made to win for the first time. But that's a fascinating look into how he was going about things. Again, he's in the last group. It's not like there's players behind him that he needs to try and chase. The tournament is ending as he finishes the final hole. So it was a little surprising to me for him in that position to not know exactly where he was and what he needed to at least make a playoff.
It just seems like competitive negligence. I mean, we've been at Torrey Pines. There are massive leaderboards. They are impossible to miss on the 17th and 18th holes. How do you just not have a short conversation on the 18th tee, like, "Hey man, let's get a birdie here, and or let's get an eagle here and get into this playoff"? Like, how do you not have that conversation, whether you're or you're in your second shot?
So
you're seeing what's happening,
right? Leishman's in the group in front of them, so you can't really do anything on the tee. But once you're in the fairway, you should be able to. You're watching what's going on, and as John said, he said the crowd didn't really react. So I thought Leishman made 5. In fact, he had made a pretty routine birdie. So. I agree. It's a tough spot to be in. You add that with the European Tour in Dubai in the morning on Sunday, when Christian Bezuidenhout is leading the tournament, is about 100 yards away, just needs to make par in the last hole, spins a wedge back into the water because he thought he needed birdie. This is a PSA to pro golfers. Hey, on the 72nd hole, it might help to know where you stand in the golf
just
tournament.
On the back nine in general. Yeah. You don't even have to wait until 8. Just it's competitive negligence to not know where you stand in the golf tournament. How you stand on the leaderboard should inform the decisions that you make on the back nine of a tournament. There's no doubt about that. It's just, it's mind-boggling to me that certainly a player of Rahm's caliber allowed himself to be put in a scenario where he didn't know.
I feel like there are situations like this that pop up from time to time. The one that always I harken back to is Jesper Parnevik at Turnberry against Nick Price in the Open in 94 when he blew the last hole, but I feel like there are many more cases of this where it's like, wow, the player didn't know where he was, than a player coming out and saying, "Hey, man, I looked at the leaderboard. I wish I didn't because
I absolutely quaked." And
right,
yes.
So it was certainly an interesting look under the hood of John Rahm, who, as you said, you know, did rally back after that horrific start. He gave himself a chance when, with 6 or 7 holes to go, it looked like he wouldn't have a chance. But second place finish, he's still at number 3 of the world. The gap between him and Rory and Brooks Koepka continues to narrow as Rahm is playing in Phoenix this week, and Brooks headlines the field in Saudi Arabia.
And Rahm can actually get to number 1 in the world this week if he wins at the Phoenix Open, and Brooks Koepka finishes outside the top 4. In Saudi Arabia, he finished in a tie for 57th last year. So it's not an improbability that Rahm can actually get to number 1 before Rory does. It's a scenario where the number one rankings up for grabs across two tours this week.
This is kind of a two-screen week for golf fans. You've got a decorated field in Phoenix. You've got Rahm, Justin Thomas, Bryson DeChambeau are all playing at Waste Management, but then you have a lot of big names going to Saudi Arabia, including Brooks, defending champion Dustin Johnson, Phil Mickelson, who remains lost. Patrick Reed is also playing among the notable Americans, and Sergio Garcia is going back for his mea culpa tour, and hopefully he won't get disqualified this time. But what are your thoughts? Where's more of your attention going to be this week?
I think it's fortunate that we can have the Saudi Arabia event in the morning, and then we can turn our attention. I know you're going out to Phoenix, so we can look at that when coverage begins in the afternoon. For me,
have a football game Sunday evening.
I heard about that. Yes. Fortunately, the golf will be over, unless it's going to be another Hideki playoff that lasts forever.
You watch your mouth.
my focus in Saudi Arabia, yes, it'll be on Brooks, but I think he's just trying to gear up for April. For me, it's Dustin Johnson. We really haven't seen him all that much over the past 6 months, obviously, because of the knee surgery. He came back at Kapalua, finishing a tie for seventh, which was certainly an encouraging sign. But to me, it felt like he was just going to go on an absolute tear this year. And I'm curious to see how he's going to play as a defending champion in Saudi Arabia. There's a lot to play for this year. He's fallen all the way to fifth in the world ranking. He's maybe not a given anymore for the U.S. Olympic team, which would have seemed unfathomable a year ago. I expect him to play well this week, and I expect him to have a big bounce back year and really solidify himself as, you know, the second or third best American, depending on what Justin Thomas does. I'm curious to see how DJ plays this week in particular.
So my interest on both events are on two guys who are in free fall. One, we talked about Phil Mickelson last week to a certain extent, but another missed cut at Torrey Pines at his hometown event. Just couldn't get it going. And
7 of 28 fairways.
That's not good. And he reversed it. He actually played decent on the difficult course and then couldn't make the birdies on the north course when he needed to shoot, you know, 1 or 2 under to at least make the weekend. So he starts the year with back-to-back missed cuts for the first time as a pro. He's going to defend next week at Pebble Beach. He really just kind of needs something in a positive direction just to get mentally set and start moving in a positive way. And so I'm interested to see if the trip to Saudi Arabia is what it's going to take. He's leaving swing coach Andrew Getson at home, so it's just going to be him and Tim Mickelson, his brother, are going to be out there, and maybe a change of scenery is going to do it. And the other one at TPC Scottsdale that I know you noted this is Jordan Spieth, who for the first time since 2013 when he was a rookie has fallen outside the top 50 in the world ranking. Finished 55th this past week at Torrey Pines, had a 2-over round in the final round, didn't earn any points for that, so he dropped from 45 to 51. And you and I both know how perilous it can be once you get outside that top 50 cusp.
Schedule starts in your own hands.
He is not currently exempt for the WGC Mexico tournament, which if he gets back into the top 50, he'll get in. But you start missing that, and then you miss out on the free points there, and you drift a little further, and now you're on the cutoff to make the match play in his hometown of Austin. And so, or not hometown, but home state. So it can be a slippery slope for a guy who for years clearly has ridden a hot hand. When things are going well with Jordan Spieth, they go really well. And when things go a little south, they can go south in a hurry.
I mean, can you imagine 5 years ago, Jordan Spieth was a couple swings away from potentially winning the Grand Slam in 2015, and now we're talking about a guy who isn't even in the top 50 in the world. And I was encouraged with his start at Torrey Pines. He actually played pretty well on the South Course, and then he exhibited some of the exact same signs that have plagued him over the past couple of years. The weekend scoring, he shot 73, 74. More erratic driving. He was 59th in strokes gained off the tee. He didn't hit enough greens. He was 75th in greens in regulation.
Yeah,
I mean, those are the three problems that have plagued him over the past couple of years. The reason why he hasn't won since July 2017, he kind of reverted back to his old ways. And look, I still think he's going to get it back. I really do. Someone who reached those heights, he's been a winner his entire life. But man, we got to start seeing something eventually, or hope just has to start dwindling. It has to.
Yeah.
It's just natural because we haven't seen enough signs of progress with his long game to think that a breakthrough is around the corner.
Yeah, it is difficult to continue to go at it month after month, and he keeps saying the right things. When he takes a short break, he takes a long break, whatever it is, he comes back, he says, I'm refreshed, I'm renewed, I have this great approach. And then the results, not only, as you said, the scores are similar, but the patterns within the rounds are so similar, and the flaws continue to creep up in the same places.
He says that he's playing the long game here, that it's not about getting results right now, that he feels like he's on the right track and that eventually he'll get those results. But when you start, as you mentioned, start creeping outside the top 50 in the world and the schedule doesn't become something that you want to have and, you know, you're forced to play other events to try and get back inside the top 50. And he's such a popular player, not just with fans, but with media as well, that every single round he plays, he's going to be asked, you know, hey, why did you shoot 74 today? Or, boy, your driving still is pretty erratic. You know, what's going on? What are you working on? When do you think it's going to get better? I mean, that just has to wear on you. And now that the season's begun, he had months to figure it out. Now that the season's begun, there's no hiding. It's not like he can go take a month or two off to continue to work on his game. He's going to have to be exposed, and
yep,
all of his flaws are there for everyone to see.
We spent a lot of time talking about the action at Torrey Pines, but there was another significant event in Dubai. Lucas Herbert ends up winning in a playoff, but I want to get your thoughts on Bryson, who not necessarily stole the show, but he was in the spotlight coming in as the defending champ. You know, the Hulk and Bulk approach was on display. He's driving greens from 375 yards away, swinging out of his shoes, and then he's tied for the lead on the back nine, looking like he's in position to go back-to-back, gets a slow play warning on the 10th hole, kept his wits about him, but then ends with four straight bogeys to drop from a share of the lead into missing the playoff by four. What's your overall take on Bryson in Dubai?
Big picture, I think we should start here. Big picture, I think it was very encouraging that he so quickly thrust himself into contention with this new body and swing. I really do. I mean, what is this, four yeah, events, three stroke play events, or individual events, I should say, to get himself in the mix, tie for lead with four holes to go. Very impressive. I think he could take a lot from that. However, that final hour also exposed the weaknesses that he currently has in his game. With this new bulk, he's said that he struggled to kind of harness all of that newfound power. And so he absolutely needed to find the fairway. 15 is a par three, but he needed to absolutely find the fairway on 16, 17, 18 to give himself a chance to make birdie. And he wasn't able to do it. Drove it in the rough each time. From there, missed the green. And then, so that's one issue.
Yeah.
Couldn't have, does not have the fairway finder that he had over the past couple of years. And secondly, he's never been a great chipper and pitcher of the golf ball. And that was exposed because now that he's bigger, he's devoid of feel. He's always looked wooden on his chip shots, and now even more so. He's lost touch, mm-hmm, around the greens. Partly of that is due to the setup of his wedges, 37.5 inches single length irons. Standard is 35 inches, but also it's technique. And so, does he change technique to deal with this new bulk that he has? Because it's just, he has a zero touch around the greens, which I think is probably going to be tougher for him to address than eventually harnessing all that power and finding the fairway.
Tiger's dialing it back. Bryson's dialing it up.
Phil's dialing it up.
Yes.
And to his detriment.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then one more before we go. We spent a lot of time discussing right now. We haven't really talked about the guy who actually won the golf tournament. Mark Leishman shoots a closing 65 on the South Course. This is his fifth win on the PGA Tour. An impressive round, an impressive resume. He's up to 20th in the world. Basically, he didn't hit a fairway either. It's like,
he had
it's like
three of 14 fairways,
and he just putted his mind out. I mean, it was an unbelievable display of irons approaching, and then certainly making the putts. He went in five holes. He went from four behind to one in the lead instantly. That's it.
I mean, what is the recipe we say every year for success at Torrey Pines?
Boy,
you've got to find the fairway. That rough is just so penal. There's no way you'd be able to put yourself in position if you're in the rough all day. And what does he do? He hits three of 14 fairways, and he still makes eight birdies.
Yeah.
I mean, he holed over 150 feet worth of putts. He gained more than eight strokes on the field on the greens. It was an unbelievable putting performance. You'd rather have that, of course, than not. And for him to get his fifth win, I think the Olympics is now back on his radar. That's going to be a very tough team to
yeah,
make
sorry,
with,
Jason
with
Day.
Cam Smith,
yeah.
Jason Day, Adam Scott. It's getting competitive all of a sudden. But Mark Leishman, I still think he's going to win a major eventually.
Okay.
I think he's too talented of a player. I'm not sure where that's going to be.
Yeah, I feel like he's in like this group.
I'm not sure this is like a launching pad for him to win one this year. But I think this just reaffirmed his talent. He can win multiple ways. It's not just how great of a ball striker he is.
I feel like he's in this bin of like 10 to 15 guys where you say, oh, he's too talented not to win a major. And then you start lining him up and say, well, you know, they are only four a year and they
he's
go
getting,
quickly.
He's getting up there in age. And
he certainly has the talent. Let's put it that way. It would never surprise me to see
yes.
Mark Leishman win a major, given his pedigree and his ability. But so this week we've got Phoenix. We've got Saudi Arabia, and we've got the football game.
Yes.
Chiefs and Niners. Give me a pick. I'm putting you on the spot.
Chiefs, 27. Niners, 20.
Wow, you like the under. This is interesting.
I don't know. You're a degenerate gambler.
Wow, this is so nice of you. I like the Chiefs as well. I don't know about score, but I appreciate.
Yeah, I was not ready to give a score. Apparently,
that's
I just
good.
Gave a score.
You did. You got to listen to the heart sometimes when it says. And then, do you have any food thoughts on Scottsdale, Phoenix, the greater area? I mean, you go to Old Town Scottsdale for sure. That's a good spot.
Yes.
Some eclectic options down there. Not necessarily the foodie destination of San Diego or Carmel next week or LA.
No, and I've only covered the Phoenix Open once, and I'll never do that again. by the way, I'm going back to Scottsdale this year. The NCAA championship, of course, will be played over 2 weeks. The men's and women's championship in Scottsdale. I look forward to exploring the food scenes more. I do know a lot of good Tex-Mex in the area. However,
yes, can't go wrong with that. Well, I am off to Phoenix. I will report back.
Please do.
It should be an interesting week. But Ryan Lavner, thank you for joining us on this edition of the Golf Central Podcast, presented by TaylorMade. I'm your host, Will Gray. We're doing this every week. You can get it wherever you get your podcast, wherever you're listening to us now. We'll look forward to talking with you again in a week, and we'll discuss all that's going on in the world of golf. Thanks for tuning in.